Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. What do soccer hooligans and Johann Sebastian Bach have in common? If you answered the ability to handle multiple voice contrapuntal lines in fugues of increasing complexity, well, good guess, but no. The right answer is they both spent their teenage years getting into trouble. Renowned conductor Sir John Eliot Gardner will join us with his new book that attempts to find the man behind the great music of Bach. And if you grew up in the 1990s, you might be a fan of a Nickelodeon show called The Adventures of Pete and Pete. Now, I didn't grow up in the 90s, but I do know that Iggy Pop had a recurring role, which in 2013 continues to blow my mind. Anyway, if you knew the show, then you'd know this song. It's mighty strange. You look good happily near and I can't sell a shoe, babe. That's the fictional band Polaris, and what essentially became the theme song for The Adventures of Pete and Pete. Playing this fake band were members of the real band Miracle Legion, led by singer and songwriter Mark Mulcahy. Well, Mark has a new solo album called Dear Mark J. Mulcahy, I Love You. And he'll be along to play some songs from it live in the studio. It'll actually be a pretty manageable setup, just two singers and two guitars, and that means we can squeeze two different live performances into our studio today. Our first live set comes from the multiple Grammy-winning violinist Hilary Hahn. She is one of the finest violinists on the concert scene today, and unlike Bach, seems not to have spent her teenage years getting into trouble, but she does have a history of doing unusual projects, including playing with singer-songwriter Josh Ritter, or the indie rock band, And You Will Know Us by the Trail of Dead. Now, she's asked an eclectic group of composers to write short, encore-style pieces for her, like this work from composer and DJ Mason Bates. Hilary Hahn and pianist Corey Smythe are going to play some of these encores for us here in the Soundcheck studio. First, from Pulitzer Prize-winning composer Jennifer Higdon, here's a piece called Echo Dash.
Thank you.
That is music from Jennifer Higdon, written for the violinist Hilary Hahn, who just played it here in our soundcheck studio. The aptly named Echo Dash, with Hilary Hahn playing the violin, Corey Smythe at our piano. It is one of the new works on the forthcoming CD called In 27 Pieces, the Hilary Hahn Encores, due out on November 11th. Hilary, welcome back.
Thank you. It's great to be back.
Echo Dash is well named. There you are dashing up and down the fingerboard, and poor Corey is like chasing after you as fast as he can with both hands, right?
Right. We take turns with the lead in a way. It's like a race where you're not sure who's going to finish first, and then we finish together.
Mm-hmm. Now, the idea of commissioning encores, it seems a little, you know, the sexy thing is to have somebody write a concerto for you or a violin sonata. And in fact, Jennifer Higdon won her Pulitzer for the violin concerto she wrote for you. Why commission these smaller, you know, encore pieces?
It's been a long time coming for me, but a while ago, maybe a decade ago, I noticed that there were a lot of encore collections coming out on CD and in publication. And I just thought, where are the new encore collections? I would be very curious to see what people would do with the form now. I love the older encores. The chestnuts are beloved for that reason, that
right.
They're fantastic pieces. But at the same time, we need to make sure that there are things also for the future that reflect every era. And there's just such wealth of variety in the ideas that are floating around these days and the exchange of technology and mm-hmm. influences that I just thought it would be really interesting to see what would come out of it.
And, as I mentioned in the introduction, you've done a lot of things within classical music, more contemporary stuff, outside of classical music altogether. So was this kind of this collection of composers, does it reflect you as a kind of a listener as well as a player?
It does. It reflects me at the time that I was listening to a whole bunch of contemporary music to see who I felt was a really good match for this project. An encore is a short piece, but it's like the short story to a novel. Short story can be an entirely different type of writing, and people can express different things in the different form. So I listened to a lot of music, and then I just went with my gut instinct. I tried to expose myself to as many types of writing as possible from as many different influences as possible. But in the end, it was when I felt really excited by a certain composer as a possible participant in mm-hmm. the project that I just went with that feeling.
And, you know, the 26 composers that you chose, we'll get to the 27th mm-hmm. in a moment, they range in age from Nico Muhly, mm-hmm. who's 32, has mm-hmm. has the big opera currently at the Metropolitan Opera, to Eino Juhani Rautavaara, the Finnish composer, who's got to be in his mid-80s by now.
Mm-hmm.
So there's several generations of composers in there.
There are.
Was that sort of, were you intentionally trying to cover a wide kind of swath of music with this?
In a way, but we also have to keep in mind that these are all individuals with individual musical voices, and you want to present with any range of repertoire. You don't want to just get stuck in one mm-hmm. area, but you want to present as much as you can. But there's no way to present even a representative proportion of the repertoire that could be written. So at some point, you just have to decide, well, this is the direction I'm going to go in, and I hope that it winds up being a good project altogether. But I just found that the pieces that people sent when they finished writing them were all very different from each other,
mm-hmm.
and each piece is its own musical world, in addition to each composer having their own language.
All right, so you chose 26 of the composers,
mm-hmm.
and then when you decided you needed a 27th, how did that happen?
I always had the idea that it would be interesting to do an open contest, because in listening to a lot of music, you miss a lot of things, and I also wanted it to be possible for students to participate. I wanted to reach out to people who are interested in writing encores. I just wanted people to think about what they would like to do with an encore to broaden the genre a little bit. And I got 400 entries approximately.
Wow.
So that's that many more new pieces that have been written under the umbrella of this project, but I hope that all of those people go out and find people to play those pieces so that they also breathe some new life into the genre.
So, but you chose, out of the 400, you chose number 27.
Angry Birds of Kauai is by Jeff Myers, who's currently in New York, so that's a local connection.
So the project is being released on CD November 11th. It's called In 27 Pieces, the Hilary Hahn Encores. Hilary Hahn and Corey Smythe performing some of the encores for us here in the Soundcheck studio. Let's listen to a lovely piece by the German pianist and composer Max Richter. This is called Mercy.
Thank you.
Violinist Hilary Hahn, pianist Corey Smythe, live in the Soundcheck studio with a work called Mercy, written for Hilary Hahn's Encore project by the German pianist and composer Max Richter, based in England for many years. And,
yes.
And Hilary, he's done a lot of post-rock kind of stuff. He produced a couple of rock bands in the UK, bands like the Twilight Sad. So he's someone for whom the distinction between the classical world and the popular world has gotten kind of blurry over the years. What about for you?
Well, for me, working with all these composers on the project, I learned about how everyone has something that they're interested in that informs their work. And I think that's the really important thing in any kind of art, but in classical music as well, that we give room to people who want to create things a certain way to follow those interests, because they'll bring all of that back into what they contribute.
And of course, they're living, breathing people, and so you can talk to them about the things
they
bring to the table. I know you love to continue to play Bach, you know, which you've done throughout your career so well. But, you know, as we'll hear from Sir John Eliot Gardner in a little while, it's kind of, we don't know a whole lot about Bach the man, so you miss that part of it. It's like, what was he thinking? What did he like? What, you know, we don't have that opportunity.
And it's a gamble. You draw a conclusion and you don't actually know for sure unless someone put it down on paper. And then you don't know if that's actually what was happening or if that's their memory of what happened or someone overheard something or guessed. But with these composers, I was able to actually ask them why they wrote this thing and why they wrote that. I did some interviews with them for my YouTube channel where I asked them about that stuff. And often the way people tell you things in interviews is different from what they tell you in conversation. And I found out a lot in the interviews that I never knew about them when we were just talking.
Okay.
So it's really fascinating to see what keeps people fresh and why they do what they do.
Well, and speaking of YouTube, I mean, you've maintained a very strong web presence, again, pretty much throughout your career. To the point that your violin case has its own Twitter and Instagram account. What kind of things does it like to talk about?
Violin case has a little bit of an attitude. So we don't always share the same opinions, but, you know, I let it be. I let it say what it wants to say.
You've also got a neat fan art page where, you know, the instructions to the fans is come and hand it to Hilary at the end of the show. So that happens? People come up to you and they give you their artwork? And
yeah, especially kids. They'll do really cute drawings of violins and like princess-type gowns and like stars and all of these things. And it's really cute. And they also do some beautiful works of art just innocently. And then there are some artists who actually recreate photos and they give me their work. I started that page because people were giving me these pieces of artwork and I wanted to share them and I wanted to make sure that other people saw them too.
All right. Well, there is an awful lot to see and to do at Hilary Hahn's website, including the sometimes snarky violin case Twitter feed and Instagram as well. The compilation is called In 27 Pieces, The Hilary Hahn Encores. It's out November 11th, but Hilary, it's been great getting a bit of a preview here in the studio today. Great to see you again.
Thank you for having us.
This is Soundcheck. Well, Hilary was just talking about the merits of working with living composers. J.S. Bach is very dead, folks, but he comes alive in a new biography written by the conductor, John Eliot Gardner. He'll join me next on Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Just about everyone is familiar with at least some music by Johann Sebastian Bach. He is one of the towering figures of Western culture, like Shakespeare or Da Vinci. But for a man who casts such a huge shadow, we don't really know a whole lot about him. The renowned conductor Sir John Eliot Gardner has spent decades studying Bach from inside his music and has collected his thoughts into an imposing new book called Bach, Music in the Castle of Heaven. John Elliott Gardner, welcome to Soundcheck.
Thank you.
You literally grew up with Bach in the house, right?
Well, it was very odd, yes. A German political refugee pitched up in Dorset, where I was born, with in his rucksack a guitar and the famous Hausmann portrait of Bach. And this was in 1936, before I was born, and he handed it to my father, whom he knew, and said, listen, the war's coming, would you look after it for me? And my dad did, and it was there. It hung on the first floor landing of our house, and I was born in 43, and I remember it for the first 10 years of my life, passed in front of it, and was disconcerted by it, discombobulated by it.
Because this is Bach as the bewigged, kind of severe old man, not a fun-looking guy.
A German politician. And scary. And I was lucky enough as a kid to start to learn some of Bach's music, particularly violin sonatas and concertos and the Brandenburgs and the motets, which I sang as a treble. And I couldn't reconcile the joyousness and the vigor and the liveliness of the music and this forbidding, stern-looking cantor.
So was that kind of the impetus for this book, to try and, you know, find the real Bach behind the music as you knew it?
I guess so, indirectly. I've always, throughout my life, wanted to find a point of conciliation between the almost mathematically precise pedagogical Bach, who wrote, you know, the Well-Tempered Clavier and the Art of Fugue, and who made such an incredible feature out of proportion and order and number, and the other Bach, which is the Bach I knew much better, which is the Bach of the two Passions, the St. Matthew Passion, St. John Passion, the B Minor Mass, the Christmas Oratorio, and then this prodigious output of church cantatas, you know, nearly 200 of them.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned the cantatas. One of his earliest cantatas, the Actus Tragicus, this is, I mean, people talk about the architecture of Bach, but here you talk about this being an early example of Bach kind of wrestling with his humanity, his mortality, dealing with death, and, you know, dealing with religion, and he sort of idolized Martin Luther. So there's a lot of that going on in this piece, isn't there?
Huge amount of it. And it's sort of symptomatic of a man who's been really buffeted by life already, by losing his parents, both his parents by the time he's 9 and a half, losing brothers, and then going on to lose 10 out of his 23 children.
And one of his two wives.
I mean, somebody who really is on the raw edge of humanity and of existence.
Hmm. This particular passage from the Actus Tragicus does have a kind of comforting sound to it. This is music by Bach, conducted by my guest, the author John Elliott Gardner. A little bit of the early Bach cantata, number 106, known as the Actus Tragicus. We're speaking with Sir John Elliott Gardner, the renowned conductor, founder of several choirs and orchestras, and conducting, is it the Monteverdi Choir and Orchestra in this recording?
Yeah.
The book is called Bach, Music in the Castle of Heaven, and much of the book looks at Bach's vocal works, the motets, the cantatas especially, the passions, the mass. You have a kind of a special connection to that through growing up with this music.
Yeah, I do, and also I love words, and I'm a wordsmith, and the whole idea of what music and words do to one another interests me. And there's a chapter in my book which I call Collision and Collusion, which is trying to look at the moments when Bach is colliding as opposed to colluding with the words, where he seems to have his own agenda, and he's being a bit subversive about the words that he's setting. And you have to remember, I think, that he's writing at a time when there's a lot of conflict in people's lives. At the beginning of the 18th century, when Germany has just emerged from the 30th War, and is on the brink of enlightenment. I mean, intellectually, the scientific revolution is catching up. And I'm sure in Bach's own school classroom, the whole idea of Galileo and Copernicus and the sun, that didn't penetrate the whole of... it was still a medieval cosmology that he was brought up. But on the other hand, in Leipzig, a university town, that was all going on. He needed to be sufficiently obedient to the clergy to justify his position as cantor. But at the same time, he was right up against them because they didn't understand his music making.
Well, that is one of the other themes that continues throughout the book is how much many of his contemporaries just didn't get it.
They didn't get it at all. And it's also symptomatic of the fact that Bach didn't write an opera, and they all did. Mm. Opera was perceived as the sexy outlet. The best career move was to become an opera composer. You earn more money that way. Bach didn't do it. Now, why? Was it an allergic reaction to opera, or did he think it trivial, or what was going on there? And it's difficult to say, but I have a feeling that it's a mixture of things. I think he objected to the two-paced nature of opera, that on the one hand, all the action takes place in recitative, which is pataphysm, and you get through it as fast as possible, and that tells you who's fighting who, who's going to bed with who. Then you have the arias, which is the moment of reflection and emotion, which describes the dilemma and the rhetoric and the emotional state of an individual character. And he thought, this is ridiculous. I'm putting words into his mouth, but I suspect he found that preposterous. So what does he do? He uses the cloak and costumes, as it were, metaphorically speaking, of opera, and puts it into church music.
So the passions have a kind of operatic quality. I mean, it's...
a dramatic quality. Yeah, I don't think they're ersatz operas. So they're not proto-operas, but they are incredibly dramatic. And it's almost as if they're mutant operas. the gene has shifted. It's jumped tracks. And it's manifested itself in an opera of the imagination rather than of the stage.
And, you know, when we talk about the Bach passions, most people talk about the St. Matthew Passion. You have a lot to say about the St. John Passion, often seen as the earlier sort of half-formed sibling to the later one.
I'm not saying it's the greater work, but I think it's the more radical of the two. It's the one that where he sets out his stall and he really delivers with it such a big punch. It's so intense, and it's all to do with John's gospel account as opposed to Matthew's account. I mean, John is an eyewitness account of the Passion story, and Bach makes us experience the Passion story through John's eyes. Mm-hmm. And that gives it a fantastic authority and currency, but also just the sheer density of the musical argument and the way that in the courtroom, I mean, the two courtroom trials, there's the Sanhedrin trial when Jesus is up in front of the high priest, and then there's one with Pontius Pilate. And he crafts them so cleverly. I mean, you sense in the Sanhedrin trial that everything is stacked up against him, that it's a kangaroo court, really. There's no chance. When he's with Pontius Pilate, it's man-to-man. The crowd is kept outside the doors. They bay, they shout, they hammer on the door, and Pilate is clearly scared of them. And he's trying to establish a direct one-to-one relationship with Jesus. Doesn't really work because Jesus gives him very monosyllabic answers. But Bach sets these two trials so brilliantly, and you feel that there is a stage set, two different stage sets, and the camera is, as it were, going from one to the other. I mean, to have that graphic imagination, to be able to to focus that into music. That's brilliant.
We're speaking with Sir John Eliot Gardiner. His new book is called Bach, Music in the Castle of Heaven. And at one point, writing about the St. John Passion, you mentioned when the opening chorus comes in, and I'm going to quote you here, something of unprecedented, shocking power occurs. From the Bach St. John Passion, a little bit of the opening chorus, conducted by John Eliot Gardiner and featuring the Monteverdi Choir and Orchestra. That moment discussed in the new book, Bach, Music in the Castle of Heaven. The Monteverdi Choir and Orchestra, one of several groups that you've founded and led over the years. You've been a pivotal figure in the so-called early music performance practice movement. Did that come from growing up and hearing performances of Bach that had this kind of grim, plodding sound to them?
Yeah, it did. I think that was a negative premise anyway, that I couldn't reconcile, just as I couldn't reconcile the portrait of this grim-looking man and the dance music that I cherished. When I heard performances of his motets and his passions, they were either on such a huge scale with enormous chorus performed on Good Friday in a kind of Victorian sanctimonious ritual, or they were Karl Richter in Germany with a very, very aggressive approach to the music. And I heard Benjamin Britten conducting St. John Passion. That was a lot better, but it was in English, and I felt that the German language is critical to an understanding of Bach. So I had to find my own way through, really, and there were no models at the time. Mm. And there's been a lot of controversy since. You know, was Bach writing for a tiny choir, a tiny ensemble of just four singers, or eight singers at the most, and single part? Was that forced on him, or was it that his ideal, or was it a pragmatic solution that he hit upon? I mean, it's a big, long, quite acrimonious debate that's been going on both sides of the Atlantic for the last 25 years, 30 years. And so there's all that to deal with, and you inch your way through towards what you think is the right solution, and then you find that there's other considerations and you want to take them on board. I find it's a perpetual voyage of discovery, and Bach is endlessly fascinating and endlessly challenging to the musician, endlessly challenging to you as a conductor.
And to you as a biographer as well, because...
Oh, enormously, because you've got so little to go on. I mean, you've got practically no family letters, no descriptions. Can you imagine? I mean, you know, all these cantatas and the passions, and there's not one clear description of how the audience, how the congregation responded to this music. I mean, did they shrug it off? Did they say it's too complex? Did they get bored? Did they go to sleep? Did they worship him? You know, what went on?
Yeah, although you do infer from things that other people wrote that, you know, as we said before, people didn't always get it.
No.
Although a select few, enough did to keep him...
Yes, I think...
Feeding the kids, the many kids.
Yes, I think it was a very hard furrow for him to plough.
Yeah.
And particularly, you know, he took on the job as cantor in Leipzig in the most unpropitious circumstances. And he was right up against the town council and the clergy right from the word go. And they lied to him. They didn't tell him the full truth of what his contract meant. So that wasn't easy for him. Yeah. And there is a floor line right down his character between a very collegial, very good father figure, very collegial to his peers and other musicians, and a cantankerous, abrasive, angry man who didn't suffer fools gladly and who couldn't understand the pig-headed nature of the opposition that he got from the town council. And he managed, nonetheless, through just dint of sheer singleness of purpose and ambition and energy to ride the storm and to produce a phenomenal amount of music.
Mm-hmm. What was that singleness of purpose?
I think it was partly innate or inherent, and it's part of his DNA that he felt as a Bach, a part of the biggest, you know, collection family of musicians in Germany in the end of the 17th, early 18th century, that he had a God-given obligation to fulfill a role as the servant of the Lord. It's a very Old Testament kind of thing.
Yeah.
And in the very first hymn book that he sang from, you see a picture of David, King David and or King Solomon at the temple surrounded by his musicians, and underneath it there's a picture of Eisenach. So the connection was made visually, graphically to him between him as a servant, as a musician serving the Lord, and being the Bach that was the one who was going to deliver the goods.
Right, because the Bach family was making music in Germany, as they say, from the time of
Luther
to the time of Bismarck.
Yeah, that's correct.
So over like three centuries of music being passed from one generation to the other. Now, all of this sounds very kind of self-righteous, and again, you know, the bewigged, severe, glum old man that you passed every day on the first floor landing of your house. But, you know, give him trumpets and drums, and something happens.
It certainly does.
Listen to this moment from the famous Bach Mass in B minor. Some of the Gloria from the Mass in B minor by Johann Sebastian Bach. My guest, John Elliott Gardner, conducting the Monteverdi Choir and Orchestra. And he is author of the new book, Bach, Music in the Castle of Heaven. The subtitle is not a random thing. I mean, you talked before about, you know, this was church music, much of it.
Yeah, but it's not churchy music.
No. No,
I mean,
it's not.
Just that Gloria that you it's not a, it's not like in Messiah where you have the angels singing and Handel brings in the angel like a squadron of aircraft and they bring the good news to Earth and then they fly off again. Bach is doing a peasant dance on Earth. Mm-hmm. It's like a painting by Bruegel. It's not a wafty esoteric thing. That's what I love about him so much.
So that kind of earthy, you know, the guy who knew all the dances, the guy who got in trouble as a teenager, lots of trouble apparently, you know, who you refer to at one point as like a reformed thug.
A proto-hooligan.
Yeah, proto-hooligan.
Yeah.
This was Bach too.
Exactly. Both sides of it. And that's what makes him so approachable.
So it's music in the castle of heaven, and yet it is very earthy music as well. Is that why people who are not Lutheran, who are not religious, will still respond to these masses and cantatas and passions?
Absolutely. You have to get through the membrane of the theology, and then you're into the uplands of extraordinary humanity, and that's what makes it so attractive.
The book is called Bach, Music in the Castle of Heaven by the conductor and now author John Elliott Gardner. And Sir John, this has been great fun having you with us. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Up next, an in-studio performance from singer-songwriter Mark Mulcahy. This is Soundcheck.
I'm a sucker for magic. Where's the rabbit? Where's the rabbit?
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. People have come to the music of Mark Mulcahy from several different angles. Maybe you remember his work with the 80s college rock band Miracle Legion. Or maybe you know Polaris, his fictional band that appeared on the Nickelodeon series The Adventures of Pete and Pete during the 90s. Still other fans know Mark Mulcahy as a solo artist. But they haven't had an album from him in about 8 years. Until now. Mark's new record is called Dear Mark J. Mulcahy, I Love You. We'll hear the story of the record in a moment, but first let's hear a song. It's called She Makes the World Turn Backwards. It's Mark Mulcahy live on Soundcheck.
Impolite and insecure. In spite of it all, she thinks you're perfect. You're fully focused, honey, on the prize. Hold his hand, dear, until he cries, Uncle. Where does it hurt? Everywhere. Can you stand up? I don't care. Are you worried? Yes! There's no explaining her behavior. We know, we know, we know. She makes the world turn backwards. Like a liar loves everything she does. Cleave yourself in two, 'cause neither one is you. Black and blue, that's just the way that it is with you. Worst is yet to come. The crowds are yelling, jump, jump, you fool. Where does it hurt? Everywhere. Can you stand up? I don't care. Are you worried? Worried? Yes! There's no explaining her behavior. We know, we know, we know. She makes the world turn backwards. There's no explaining her behavior. She makes the world turn backwards. There's no explaining her behavior. She makes the world turn backwards. There's no explaining her behavior.
She makes the world turn backwards.
We know, we know, we know.
That is Mark Mulcahy with Ken Murie live on Soundcheck, doing Mark's song She Makes the World Turn Backwards live on Soundcheck. Mark, was that a little allusion to the Hendrix song at the very end there, Wind Cries Mary?
You're the first to notice that.
Really?
including me, yeah. No, I didn't know that, but that's nice, yeah. That's sweet.
It's three.
It's great to be any part of Hendrix's legacy, if I am.
Well, Mark, I was talking at the top of the segment about various ways people would have come to your music, and I left out the last time you were on Soundcheck, which you reminded me of when we came in today. 10 years ago, you guys were here with Ben Katcher and Gloria Deluxe for a kind of opera project that you were doing. So
yeah, that was 10 years ago? Jeez.
It was a long time ago.
That's when we were doing, one of the operas. We were doing it at the Kitchen for a week, I think.
Right. So, but you've been away from our show for a long time and been away really from recording, or at least from releasing records for a long time as well. And I want to make that distinction because I know that there's this new record and then there's like another one that you've been working on as well, right?
Yeah, I was recording. I was recording all along. I just didn't put anything out.
Right. Why the album title, "Dear Mark J. Mulcahy, I Love You"?
You know, I got a note from somebody saying that, and so I liked it, and I tried it out on a lot of people, and it sounds like, you know, when you hear it, it's like egotistical sounding, but it isn't at all. If you look at it. And so then I was talking to a friend of mine, and we just were discussing the punctuation, and he said, you know, we were talking about the comma
after your name.
Yeah. And so I thought, right, the comma is all there is. And then suddenly at that moment it hit me that that could just be the whole album. I don't have to put the name of my album by me. And something about that I really loved. I loved it being like more like a movie title.
Yeah.
So that's what sort of pushed me over the edge about it. Because, you know, you bat the title around a lot, and there's always other titles that you could call it.
Right.
Cabbage Man and...
Cabbage Man fishing, by Mark J. Mulcahy.
Fishing over here. so it took a little... I had some doubt, but not enough.
So do you remember who sent you that note or that letter?
I do. A friend.
Uh-huh.
A person, yeah.
Okay. I mean, it strikes me that, you know, in the years since you were away, I mean, your wife had died and you've been raising your twin daughters. And a bunch of musicians after the passing of your wife did this record called Chow My Shining Star, this benefit.
Right.
It strikes me that that title, Dear Mark J. Mulcahy, I Love You, could have been the title of that record.
That's nice. And that whole thing was such a surprise, you know, that I didn't know any of that was happening about the record being made, and I didn't know all those people were willing to sort of put their time in. So, yeah, maybe so.
We're talking about people
And I did think, again, the title, when I saw that, I thought, you know, that does apply to my sort of lucky part of my life, that a lot of people do love me and a lot of people do want to help me. And without, you know, sounding like I'm in therapy, it didn't feel, just in a super organic way, it just summed a lot of things up. Not to mention making the record that I was making was all done with friends and all done in a kind of super organic, sweet way. So there's a lot of reasons to call it that.
Yeah.
Not just that I got the note.
So that benefit, that compilation called Chow My Shining Star, I mean, we're talking about people like Michael Stipe of R.E.M., Tom York of Radiohead, Dinosaur Jr., all these. And like some younger musicians, too.
Yeah.
Who probably... you know, grew up on some of your music, either Polaris with Nickelodeon or the band Miracle Legion, I would think.
Yeah, well, even Tom York, who's not necessarily he's younger than me, I think, by a little bit, but him and I know his brother Andy, they came up, the song he did was called All for the Best, which is a Miracle Legion song. I'll tell you, man, that guy loves that song more than, it might be his favorite song, because when I talk to him about it, he can't stop talking about it.
Wow.
And so it's funny, yeah.
So now you said that the process of making this record was a really kind of organic one. You're playing with friends and stuff.
Right. Ken and I have a friend called Henning Olenbush, who was the producer of the record, has a studio in his house. And we just kind of came up with making a record one song at a time. All the recording for each song would be done in a day.
So how long did it actually take to make the record?
11 days. 11 songs, 11 days. The real hard and fast rule was we have to finish in the day, and we did slightly go back to one song to fix the flute. But in general, it was all...
always got to fix the flute.
What's wrong with you? He just couldn't bear it, you know? You know those guys are. I really want to try again.
But you didn't do this in one 11-day stretch.
No, it's still... Making a record always takes a year, and it still took a year. But it was 11 days of 1 year.
Right.
It was sort of a Saturday in each month.
Got it.
You know.
So, and the results are there for all to hear on the album Dear Mark J. Mulcahy, I Love You. We should probably hear another song from it. You want to do Poison Candy Heart?
Yeah.
All right.
Okay, so it starts with whistling. So if you're whistling at home,
all right.
Get ready while you work.
Once again, Mark Mulcahy with Ken Murie live on Soundcheck.
foolish little waste of time. You pucker up like lemon lime. I'm sinking into your corduroy. I saw you kissing the paper boy. You're smart enough to keep it light. You call me up with a landmine. Driving drunk with a baby in the trunk, and the whole town knows you're no good, you're no good, you're no good. You hardly ever say yes. Oh, baby, try the sofa. You're gonna clean this up. Probably me, like I always do. You got a poison candy heart. You're serious but wonderful. Reckless as a chainsaw. Thrilling in the bedroom. And I'm average in so many ways. You only want what's best for you. I do too, I do too, I do too. You hardly ever say yes. Oh, baby, try the sofa. Who's gonna clean this up? Probably me, like I always do. You got a poison candy heart. You got a poison candy heart. You got a poison candy heart. You hardly ever say yes. Oh, baby, try the sofa. Who's gonna clean this up? Probably me, like I always do. You're happiest when I'm not, and I can live with that. You try to kill us apart. You got a poison candy heart.
That's fun. Poison Candy Heart, live performance here in our Soundcheck studio. Mark Mulcahy's song from his album, Dear Mark J. Mulcahy, I Love You, which is out now. I know you must get asked a lot whether Miracle Legion is going to reform. I'm not going to ask you that. But your fake band, Polaris, actually did sort of reform for a one-off last year. This is the band that did the music for the Nickelodeon show, The Adventures of Pete and Pete.
Right.
About which I know little, except that Iggy Pop was on it.
A lot of people, yeah, Stipe and
really?
Steve Buscemi. They could imagine whoever they wanted somehow and get them. It was a very under-the-radar show for, you know, the corporate...
Yeah, but apparently, you know, with a real serious cult following.
Right. Well, it seems like it just keeps lasting. And so the Polaris part of it, we were, you know, I wrote the music and then we invented this band and we were in the opening of the show every week. And so we never played. I never thought anything of it because it was just a thing to do. And then so I don't know how long it's been. It's been something like almost 20 years. And so last summer they had this thing in L.A., the sort of Pete and Pete convention-ish, and they booked a pretty big theater, like a 2,000-seat theater, which sold out very quickly. We came out to play, and every song, like the first note, it was like being whoever, the Beach Boys, you know, you play the first note of the song, and the place went bananas every time we started the song, so it's got a life.
So it becomes almost a philosophical question. Can you reform a band that never formed officially to begin with?
Right. We want to.
All right.
Where are the opportunities, John?
Well, Mark, to you and Kenny, it's been great fun having you guys performing for us here in the studio today. Congratulations on the new record. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And here is a little bit, actually, a hit tune from that old band, Polaris.
By guilt, Charlie, I thought you had it coming. Yes, it is. Does she talk back?
Well, we were able to squeeze in two live sets on Soundcheck this time around, but in fact, we weren't able to squeeze in all of Mark's set. There is an additional song which you can find on our website, soundcheck.org. Tomorrow on the program, REM released their landmark album, Green, 25 years ago tomorrow. We'll revisit the album, the band's first for a major label, with our guests, Mike Mills of REM and music critic J. Edward Keyes. Plus, the Australian band Hiatus Coyote is riding a wave of buzz started by online chatter from Prince, Erykah Badu, and Questlove. They'll play live in our studio. Marco Benevento is responsible for our theme music. It's called Eagle Rock, and you can find out more about it on our website, soundcheck.org. That'll do it for today. Join us again tomorrow. I'm John Schaefer. This is Soundcheck.